interesting, though, about the kids. They said the kids are fighting this thing off no problem.
So far.
Yeah, well, so yeah, far. So far.
Thank God.
They said that my both my daughter and son-in-law are high school teachers. And so one school, it's up in Boston. So one school, there was one agent, a lot of agents in the school, especially in the Boston area. And they're traveling. And there's 14 cases from a Biogen convention. 14 or 18.
But here's our president.
There you go.
You know what?
He doesn't know who to blame about. It's a Democrat. So I like to get him out of it. It's a Democrat. It's
quick.
It's a Democrat that fires Bernie Sanders. Started.
Oh, he did.
year after year. Everybody's excited for you. I've been selling tickets all week.
Let's see if this works. I hooked it up this morning. I put on three of
them. I like that little paranoia in the morning. That's good. Did you drive from Miami?
No, I did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my yard likes it. That's all a good sign.
The mic that we have to use is this one.
Yes.
We can rove.
If you'd like one to rove, I'll put make sure there's a fresh battery in it.
Okay, yeah.
I'll give you one. FAU is going to call in a second, and you're going to top one.
That's it. Let's see if it opens.
Let's just put it on the desktop. It plays better from the desktop. And what I'm going to do is I'm audio recording you in the background, and we're going to put you on the internet too. If anybody can see, the command isn't performing because the dialog box is open. No, I don't want to escape. It's telling me to be patient. I'm totally impatient with these toys.
Me too.
And you got a clicker with a light pointer, and it's just forward and reverse. And it just looks like what we want it to be.
Yeah.
So let's bring it to town. That's the sound I wanted to hear.
Welcome to a Florida Atlantic University meeting. You are entering now. You are the only participant.
Everybody's coming to see you. So now we just go share. It's got the backlights kind of lit. Is it kind of dead?
Yeah, how much light will come out here? We'll get the lights down. So.
Hang on. Yeah, we can bring it down a little bit. And there you are. So you know what? We can bring it down. It turns off the front lights.
Perfect. So I just... Okay.
And there you are.
Perfect.
Good morning. Yes. Well, you tell me.
Yeah.
That's you guys. Real small up at the
Joe
top.
Ray? No, that's...
Yeah, FAU's the bridge, and then they send it out to whoever calls in. I like that part best.
So then, the only thing we need, if you can get, so if I take a walking mic, can't get in front of this, right?
You can, if you get real close, it'll act up, but we'll just twist it away.
Gotcha.
Let me just get you a fresh battery, and we'll be all set. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to Grand Rounds. First, I do want to make an announcement that tomorrow evening there is a physicians forum at 6 p.m. in this room to discuss this issue in terms of the hospital's response. Obviously, this is an issue that has created a lot of angst and stress for our patients and ourselves and our families. That's why we decided to invite Dr. Larry Bush, who has been a longtime supporter of our CME activities here at Boca Regional. Dr. Bush received his medical education from the Medical College of Pennsylvania and did his residency at the University of Pennsylvania in internal medicine. He did his fellowships in infectious disease at the Medical College of Pennsylvania. He's board certified in internal medicine and a subspecialty in infectious disease. He's currently the director of infectious disease education at Wellington Regional Internal Medicine Residency Program, and he's the president-elect of the Palm Beach County Medical Society. He is the affiliated professor of medicine at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, affiliated professor of clinical and biomedical sciences at FAU Charles Schmidt College of Medicine. He is a medical journal reviewer on several journals, including infectious disease journals, and it is my pleasure to welcome to give us this very important talk on COVID.
Thank you. All right, well, thank you. Good to be here, and thank you for attending. And obviously, I'm not an expert in COVID. I don't know if anybody really is. I think the take-home message is these viruses are going to do what they do, and what we do makes a difference for our patients and for the myths and the facts and the fear. So I think I'm going to talk about COVID, but before I get to that, I'm going to talk about just epidemics and emerging infections and things, how those happen by themselves. If you look at emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases, there are three driving forces, right? It's the environment, the host, and the pathogen. You know, some of those you can control, some you can't. The issue for me really is that you can't control the environment. The environment's changing drastically. I'm going to talk about overgrowth of population, and frankly, as sad as it sounds, this is how the population takes care of itself. And I'm going to show you some statistics about the population and why these things occur, and they're going to occur more frequently, especially as the world is so global and that international travel is overwhelming. On the other hand, you had the pathogens, and the pathogens have always been around, and pathogens are going to survive like humans. That's why there's bacterial resistance. And they're going to change, and the more pressure they're put under, the more chance they have to change. They're going to take the chance to change so they can survive themselves. And then there's the hosts. So 20% of the population in this country right now, which is the fourth most populated country in the world, even though we only make up 4.4% of the world's population. Think about that. We're the third most populated country in the world, making up 4.4%. But 20% as of 2020 is over the age of 65. And people over the age of 65 have less robust immune systems, have more comorbidities, and when they get infected with an organism, they're more likely to do poorly. So none of those things are a surprise. So having said that, if you look at what's an emerging infectious disease, well, an emerging infectious disease is a little bit different than a re-emerging infectious disease. This is a re-emerging infectious disease with a virus that's been around forever that's sort of mutated differently, and now because we don't have immunity to it and because it's quite contagious, it's spreading. And the reason for emerging infectious diseases could be global or regional, and we live in a global society right now, and the same goes for those. And then we rely on organizations. Now, you know, I'm making a little bit of parody about the Director General of the World Health Organization. He's from Ethiopia. I don't know exactly what the qualifications are to get in that position or how you're chosen or what. And that's not anything disparaging about he. I don't really know anything about him. But what I would say is that when you look at the World Health Organization, I would put more credence in the CDC. For me personally, because I know a lot of those folks, I've worked with a lot of those folks, and I believe that they don't have a dog in the race. I think that what you hear is what they know. They're not financially connected. I write for MixApp, and I got to tell you, I can't write a MixApp question in infectious disease that has any product in it that I have anything to do with the company. And we spend hours scrutinizing that. So I write the Merck manual, and once in a while I'll put a question in the MixApp infectious disease that has something to do with a Merck product. Like I'll say the patient is on, you know, Zocor, which I didn't know we even know is a Merck product. Oh, my God, did that raise red flags? Like, I'm promoting Zocor. So So when you look at that, I think the CDC doesn't really have that thing, and I think they vet their people very well. I would believe what they say. They have their own journal called Emerging Infectious Diseases, which if you would read that, you'd be afraid to go out of your house every day. So having said that, if I can get this to move. A little technical problem. What do you suggest? I knew you were going to be able to fix this. Somehow. Just this?
Yep.
Great. So if you look at emerging infectious diseases in the world since 1973, does it surprise you that rotavirus came and went? We have a vaccine, the cryptosporidium, nobody really cared about until HIV. The Ebola virus, the largest Ebola outbreak in the world is taking place right now in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I haven't seen an article in the lay press about that in so long. Do you know that there's a 95% effective Ebola virus that Merck actually marketed a few months ago? When's the last time you read about that, right? Vaccine. Why don't we read about that? Well, the first case of Ebola virus that rolls into New York City, you'll read about it. Do you know that there's an antiviral medication now available for smallpox? Does anybody really know that? Or how you would get it, or how you prescribe it, or what it is? And if there was a smallpox epidemic or an outbreak or a bioterrorism event right here, there's one available. When did you ever see that on the newspaper? It just doesn't make much sense for anybody to print that because nobody's really concerned about it. In 1977, I lived in Philadelphia when the Legionnaires outbreak occurred, and the University of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia General Hospital was loaded with people with Legionnaires disease now. I was in Philadelphia because of a mix-up a few months ago, and I walked by the Bellevue Stratford where this occurred, the Legionnaires convention, and I watched all these people walking in and out, and I said to my wife, who's a physician, I said, we could stop here and take a poll. Who knows the significance of this building? Nobody. Nobody. And Legionella, right, was not a new organism. But the microbiology people at the University of Pennsylvania diagnosed what the organism was at that time. In 1977, we had the hantavirus. We still have hantavirus, Campylobacter, HTLV-1, a neurologic disease, a cancer disease, different types of toxin-producing Staph aureus, and then we had hemolytic uremic syndrome from a certain type of enterohemorrhagic E. coli. HTLV-2, still trying to figure out what that causes, maybe leukemia. Lyme disease, the most common vector-transmitted disease in this country. Yeah, people are worried about Lyme disease, but not so much anymore. In fact, the vaccine was available, went away because it got no buy-in. The company stopped manufacturing it because people just didn't buy into it. And then, of course, the greatest epidemic that ever happened in the world was HIV, and it's still going on. But HIV patients now are taking a single pill, probably easier to treat than hypertension, Helicobacter pylori. Right? We found the cause of cancer. Helicobacter pylori, a cause of cancer. Hepatitis A is the most foodborne transmitted hepatitis virus in the world, but we think of A when E is the most common. Hepatitis C, we have a cure for hepatitis C. Guanidio virus, all sorts of unusual things. Which brings us to all of a sudden we started seeing coronaviruses that changed in 2003 with SARS, and SARS went away. And we didn't name it after any country per se then, even though it did come from Asia. And then we have right here, right there on the left, anthrax bioterrorism. The one case of anthrax in the mail came from your community. Wow, your community. Came from your community, right down the street at the AMI building. And these are the global examples of emerging and reemerging infectious diseases in the world, and they're not going to stop. They're going to continue. They're going to evolve, and they're going to emerge and reemerge. So why are we so surprised about respiratory tract infections? If you look at the leading killers in the world, it's always been respiratory tract infections for a very easy reason, because we all breathe and we all cough and we all touch fomites, and they're easily transmitted. And some of these cause severe disease. So let's just take influenza. Influenza, complicated by secondary bacterial pneumonia, is the sixth leading cause of death in people over 65 in this country. If you get in the hospital with community-acquired pneumonia on a regular floor, you have a 6% chance of not leaving. You're going to die 6% of the time. If you're in the ICU, it's around 10 to 20%. We don't talk about those too much. AIDS, diarrhea diseases, TB, malaria, measles. These are the leading causes, but if you look at the far left thing, you can see that half of them are usually in people who aren't children. Children tend to die of diarrhea diseases. And then factors responsible for emerging infectious diseases are ecologic changes, agricultural development, things such as restoration. Why all of a sudden did we see so much Lyme disease? Because we moved into the deers. They didn't move into us. We moved into them. Everybody wants to live in a wooded place around their backyard deck where they can look at the deer. Well, that's fine, but with the deer come the mice, and with the mice comes the tick, and with the tick comes the bacteria. And oh, by the way, the tick also carries anaplasmosis and borreliosis and other things. So why that's a surprise to anybody is beyond me. It's like moving into a war zone and wondering why you got hit by a missile. You moved into the deer zone, not you, all of us. And then if you look at changes in human demographics, inflation of population size. So let's go over that. From the year one after the current era, right, to be politically correct, the current era, it took until 1827 till there were a billion people on the planet. It took the next 100 years to get to 2 billion people, right? Between the time that the Palm Beach County Medical Society has been in existence and we just had our 100th anniversary, the world's population has tripled in 100 years. The world's population has doubled since 1970. You get the point? There's too many people living near each other, and they travel around very easily. 7.8% of anybody who's ever walked on this planet is alive today. Think about that. 7.8% of anybody who's ever been alive on the planet Earth is living today. That is an enormous number. We have numbers that look like this. And the thing is that the majority of the population is occurring in areas where the infrastructure and public health is bad, right? You don't think there's a lot of airborne wounds in the part that's in the dark blue up there, do you? In that part of the world, that's the part of the world that's growing. And if that occurs, which is going to occur, diseases are going to become more contagious and more rampant. How about international travel? U.S. residents traveling abroad. This is an old slide, but you get the idea on the graph that it's going up. In 2015, 1.2 billion international tourists arrived. Well, in 2015, there were around 7 billion people on the planet, which means 1 out of 7 were traveling. In 18, it's estimated to go up to 2 billion, which means almost 20% of the population, or 25% of the population, is traveling. And if you look at where they're going to, 75% go to malaria zones where we don't have a vaccine. So are we surprised that Zika showed up? Are we surprised that chikungunya showed up? I'm not surprised. It's a question of when's it going to show up, not if it's going to show up. If you look at the average annual number of global airline passengers by decade, this is a decade old, but look at that number. And then you actually look at the commercial air traffic in a 24-hour period. How can you avoid a coronavirus coming from anywhere in the world showing up in the United States? You can't. How about that? That's the global air network every day. Every one of those lines, which have become a blob, is air traffic. I wonder how they don't run into each other. Right? That's amazing when you think of how many planes are in the sky. So this is the reason for epidemics and emerging diseases and re-emerging diseases. Where do people tend to go? Well, where do people tend to go? In this country, people tend to go to Mexico, Canada, Europe, but a lot of people go to Asia. And if you look at the most commonly traveled areas in this country, China is number 5 on the list there. So 3.5 million people, or 3% of people who travel in this country, go to China every year. Of course, Mexico and Canada are going to lead the list. And then you have international mass gatherings. Look at between 2019 and 2022, right? Religious gatherings, sporting events, arts and music. Look at the numbers. Just go down to religious gathering, the top one. Projected attendance, 40 million people. Go down to the sporting events, the 2020 Summer Olympic Games, if they occur, right? 7.5 million people. It's almost like what Zika did to Brazil during the Olympic Games. The poor Olympics are getting hurt by epidemics and pandemics. So the major factors contributing to the emergence of infectious disease are demographics, behavior, technology and industry, economic, international, microbial adaptation, and breakdown of public health measures. I mean, you see the news, I see the news, go out to California. People sleeping in tents on the street cannot be a healthy situation. Why do you think we had such a big outbreak of hepatitis A? There's two reasons. Homelessness and IV drug use. That's the reason. Why all of a sudden were we having deaths in Melbourne, in Martin County, from hepatitis A? because it breaks down the public health measures. So what is a pandemic? Well, an epidemic is a disease that occurs with greater frequency than expected. If there's one case of Ebola, you don't expect any, that can be called an epidemic. A pandemic is when basically it's involving multiple portions of the world. Yes. Okay. Great. All right, so we've had pandemics. We've had AIDS, TB, malaria, all of them in tropical regions, but now they're in temperate regions also. When you look at what the World Health Organization does, they put out warnings for pandemics. Now, this is an old slide. We're not really in three because we have evidence of increased human-to-human transmission. Now, you could say, is there evidence of significant human-to-human transmission? It depends on who's defining significance, but there's definitely increased human-to-human transmission. That's a given. The problem is the numbers are not very accurate because you only test the people who are sick, and we've only been testing large amounts of people since last week when it became available out of the CDC. Now, I know the CDC took a big hit for why didn't they release the test earlier. Well, you know, as of yesterday, you can order the test from LabCorp. Do you know that? You can send a respiratory PCR and package it like a viral culture like you would for herpes or anything else, and send it to LabCorp, and you'll get an answer in 3 to 4 days. When we get to the latter part of the talk, I'll ask, what are you going to do with that patient during the 3 to 4 days? And what are you going to do with them when it comes back positive? So then, we have pandemics all the time, but let's talk about the major one that occurs often, that's going to keep occurring, and that we have epidemics on a yearly basis. Let's talk about the flu. So the history of the flu is it was first mentioned by Hippocrates. He sort of mentioned everything in 412. In 1580, really, you know, when you're the only runner in the race, you're probably going to win, right? Okay. In 1580, the first pandemic was described. In 1580 to 1900, there were 28 pandemics. You may not know this, but there's actually three types of flu. And I'm always shocked when people talk about the bird flus. All type A influenza viruses are bird viruses. The reason they change and the reason we get them because the bird helps mix them recombinantly with a mixing vessel, another animal, pigs and horses and other animals, and then we get infected with a virus that we've never been exposed to before. Type B are humans only, and that's a large reason why, a lot of other virologic reasons, why they seem to be less aggressive than type A, because there's less of them mixing with other animals and birds. Type C are humans only also. We don't even consider type C. We don't vaccinate it against it. We don't do drug testing against it. So how do flu viruses change? Well, flu viruses can be considered the chameleons in the microbial world. I don't know why it's doing that. What do we say? Gary, I think we need you to sit here. What's doing this? Am I doing that? So they can be considered the chameleons of the microbial world because they're always changing and they're always going to change. If you look at influenza, you know, it's felt that there are 17 H's to hemagglutinin and up to 10 neuraminidases. Humans only get infected with 3. Yes, we've been infected. You've heard of H5 and H9 and H7. And those are the ones that are scary. But in essence, human influenza A viruses are between H1 and H3. And they change from poultry to humans to pigs to horses to aquatic animals to domestic animals to animals that would be in jungles, etc., cats. So these are always going to change. And because of that, you get pandemics. So flu pandemics are global epidemics of a newly emerged strain. There were 3 in the last century. We're in a new century. Fortunately, we haven't seen another one. The worst one killed 20 to 40 million people worldwide. There's estimates that it killed 100 million people worldwide. This is the emergence of a new flu strain that really is what causes it. Few, if any, people have immunity to the new flu strain, and this allows for the spread very widely. It's sort of very simple idea of why diseases become epidemic and pandemic. If you look at the timeline of emergent and pandemic influenza viruses in humans, you can see going back to 1918, the so-called Spanish flu. My wife's a Spaniard. She's a pathologist. She was watching TV last night, and somebody was blaming, you know, why do we call this the Wuhan virus? Sounds like we're blaming people in Wuhan for doing this. And she said, nobody seems to care about calling it the Spanish flu for the last 100 years. So she said to me, do you know why it's called the Spanish flu? I said, I know, Maria, but you could tell me again. She said, because it was the Spaniards who discovered that there was a flu epidemic. They didn't cause it. Then we talk about syphilis, and I say, so was syphilis brought to America, or did Columbus bring it back with him? Tell me how that went. So particular changes, characteristics of normal flu A viruses to annual epidemics, right? The A virus undergoes frequent changes. Some of them are minor. We call them drift. Some of their manges, we call them shift. And when there's new ones that we call a shift, the problem is that there's a big deal. Drifts, that's why the vaccines changed every year. The World Health Organization and the CDC being involved in it looks at what's going on in the Southern Hemisphere, decides what may be in the Northern Hemisphere, and makes a vaccine at their best guess of what virus, what drift we need a vaccine to cover our population at this point in time. And are they wrong? Yeah. But how many times do you and I make a wrong diagnosis? The bottom line is most people with a drift that the vaccine wasn't effective of do okay. Doesn't make much difference. And most people we make a wrong diagnosis with that we congratulate ourselves for helping them. No, we just didn't hurt them. Right diagnosis, wrong diagnosis. I tell the residents all the time, unless you almost kill the patient, most times they'll get better, right? Humans are pretty resilient. I said it's the 5% that make a difference. Maria says that to me all the time. Pathologists can read 95% of the slides right. I want to hire the person who can read the 5%. Because that makes the difference. What's the difference if you call it gastritis or hyperplasia? Missing a cancer cell makes a difference. So then the changing variability of influenza is the antigenic drift, which I said, which causes the seasonal flu. And then you have the shift. Well, the shift is a problem because now when you shift, we don't have immunity. And shift occurs because of antigenic combination between birds and humans and animals. And when that occurs and the shift occurs, you can get an epidemic, and if it gets worldwide because of the global spread, you can get a pandemic. So how do antigenic shifts occur? Well, respiratory epithelial cells, human viruses, non-human viruses, there's a reassortment, and all of a sudden that virus that could not attach to our epithelial cell, we'll talk about coronavirus doing something maybe similar, attaches to us, and these things get mixed in migratory water birds, they're all called avian flu, and they mix with animals. And if it becomes adaptable to humans, we get this. We get three pandemics in the last decade. Excuse me, 100 years. 1918, the Spanish flu, large amounts of people died. Asian flu in H2N2, nobody's blaming Asia. That's where it emanated. Less people died. Why did less people die in 57? Well, for the obvious reason. We were better at taking care of sick people in 57. Show me a ventilator in an ICU in 1918. How many ventilators do you think there are in the United States of America? How many isolation rooms do you think you have in that building across the parking lot? I mean, ask them one day, how many mechanical ventilators do you have here? There's probably less than 100,000 in the entire country. Think about it. Between the east coast of Florida and drive to the west coast, Lee County, where Fort Myers is, and pass through that, the last hospital you pass is Hendry, Clewiston, right? They have a one-bed ICU. How many ventilators do you think are between Clewiston and the other part of the state? None. They'd have to come to Palms West, Wellington, and make their way to the east coast of Florida, the far east coast, Palm Beach County, to get a ventilator. So there's not too many. And if you look at the most fatal event in human history, I love this slide because look at the graph on the bottom. So in 1900, the life expectancy in the United States was felt to be around 52 years old. And that went up to about 54 in 1912. In 1918, it was approaching 55. It amazed me that Ben Franklin lived to his 80s. That amazes me because, you know, many people didn't. He didn't look too healthy when I looked at pictures of him. But when you look, didn't he look like he had metabolic syndrome? Really? When you look at this graph, look what happened in 1918. The life expectancy dropped 15 years in 1 year. 1 year. Amazing. And then obviously, what happened? The world accommodated. Humans accommodated. Humans are going to accommodate the COVID-19, obviously. How do I know that? I'll tell you at the end of this. If you look at what killed influenza, that's what killed him. What were they offering that guy? Nothing. Hope. The Wizard of Oz. What was behind the curtain? Really, when Toto pulled down the curtain, what was behind there? Hope. That's what he gave Dorothy. Hope. Nothing else. Didn't have any medicines, antiviral, ventilator, antibiotics, recombinant drugs. Nothing like that. U.S. Army training camps. This is what was going on. If you look at schoolhouses, I mean, isn't that what's being thought of now, closing schools? Articles in the paper. You can't pick up the paper now where you can't read of how many died. I don't know how many are sick. So when we look at that number, how many died, I don't know the denominator. Nobody knows the denominator. So I look at that death rate, and I was sad to see something in the paper the other day that said that the global death rate is something like 3.8%, but the United States is 5.4%. Why is that? Because of more accurate reporting of what the denominator is. That's the reason. And the numbers are really hard to tell. People were being buried in mass graves because you couldn't really bury people fast enough. They were lining the hearse up outside funeral parlors, one funeral after another. So lessons learned that these are unpredictable. They're going to occur. There's variations in mortality and severity of illness, particularly as the population ages. The rapid surge in number of cases is usually a brief period of time. This will be a brief period of time for a lot of reasons. They tend to occur in waves and subsequent waves, but the key lesson is unpredictability. Isn't that what Yogi Berra said? He said the one thing about prediction is you can't predict the future. Really, what else would you predict? The past? I mean, right? So the CDC. Well, the CDC does their best. They do virologic surveillance, morbidity surveillance, mortality surveillance. They have local state health departments. They all feed into the CDC, and they make recommendations. But if you look at this, just put this into context of coronavirus. Look at 2010 all the way to the end of 2018. Look at the estimated U.S. flu burden by season. It's growing. It's growing, not shrinking. Look at the amount of deaths. 2017 to 2018, it was estimated that 61,000 people died of influenza. How many people have died of coronavirus as of today? And I can't keep track with the numbers fast enough. As of today in the United States, died in the United States, right here in this country. I don't think 25 have died. The numbers are very hard to keep up with. Now, we're 2 months plus into the epidemic. Last year, flu season, 61,000 people. Look how many people were estimated to be hospitalized, almost a million. Look how many people were estimated to have the flu. It's felt that the contagious rate of the flu is around 2 people for every 1 infected. For measles, it's around 17. Look at how many, 45 million. That's 15% of our population. Look at the preliminary cumulative estimate of hospitalizations in the U.S. for this flu season. Look how high it is. Now, having said that, I can put the numbers here. This is 2019-2020. So far, estimated 32,000 to 45,000 dead, 14 million to 21 million medical visits, 310,000 to 560,000 hospitalizations, and the deaths down here, 18,000 to 46,000 for this year. That's huge. So, flu, everyone should get vaccinated. Isn't that the recommendation? Well, the question is, why don't people get vaccinated? A, I got vaccinated last year and I got the flu. We have to stop calling upper respiratory tract infections flu. We shouldn't even call them flu-like. Call them upper respiratory tract infections. We don't need to name it, right? Well, when people have diarrhea and we say you have a viral gastroenteritis, I don't know too many viruses that infect the stomach, first of all, so I don't know why we call it gastroenteritis. It's enterocolitis in my mind. Number two is, how do you know that's what they have? Why'd you call it a virus? Maybe it's the first presentation of their inflammatory bowel disease. Not you calling it a virus, we collectively. I think we have to stop calling things that they're not because it confuses our patients. But how effective are the vaccines? Well, you can see in 2014 to 15, the vaccine was not very effective. That doesn't mean it doesn't mitigate against disease. It just means it wasn't very good at totally preventing disease. And last year, it wasn't very effective, 29%. This year, the CDC estimates it's somewhere in the upper 40s. That means half the people can get the flu. Yes, but they may get a less severe flu. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't vaccinate them. And then the CDC will give you all this information with the confidence intervals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line, it doesn't matter. Either you're going to get the flu, you're not. Either we're going to get infected with coronavirus, we're not. We have to do common sense things. Flu vaccine is a very common sense thing. But having said that, as you know, common sense is a very common. And the Healthy People 2010 goal for vaccination for influenza was terrible. And if you look at the people over 65, it was terrible for that group, which is the most likely group to die of influenza. But what gets even worse is look at this. This is a hospital out west which sits on 441 and Forest Hill Boulevard that begins with the letter W, but I won't name it. This is last year's flu vaccination. So the green is they got vaccinated. The yellow is they declined. And the red is they didn't decline, they didn't get vaccinated, they abstained, I guess. Right? Okay. Who are the best people at getting vaccinated, right? Well, who's got the total green line? The medical residents and students. Bottom line, you don't get vaccinated, don't come in the door. Bottom line, they didn't have a choice. Now, what would the ACLU say about that, right? I don't know what it is at Boca Regional, but are nurses allowed to work if they don't get seasonal flu vaccine? The ones who walk in the room with the mask on with the core measure flu vaccine for the poor woman or man sitting in the bed, and they say, what is that? That's your flu vaccine. And the patient says, oh, I see you got a little star on your whatever, and you're wearing this mask. Why is that? Well, to prevent, because, you know, prevent flu. Oh, did you get vaccinated? No. Why? I don't think it works. I think it's bad for you. So you want to give me one? Doesn't make any sense. Look at just nursing. Look along the bottom line there. Look at medical oncology. Look at NICU, pharmacy, PT, respiratory, nursing, ICU. In the ICU, half of the people didn't get vaccinated. Half of the people who work in the ICU did not get vaccinated. But, you know, it's not all about flu, and that's how we're going to get into corona. Does anybody remember enterovirus D68 or even what that was or who got it or what it caused? That enterovirus, which we all get exposed to, the most common cause of aseptic viral meningitis, happened to have a strain that was now numbered and lettered that caused neurologic disease in kids. Anybody remember that? Didn't make a lot of head noise. Didn't have too many cases in the East Coast, mostly in the Midwest and Far West. Sort of disappeared on us. So let's talk about the coronaviruses, right? So I'm going to talk about this stuff as far as we know, but really as far as I know. So what's the 2019 coronavirus? Well, if you look at human coronaviruses, they make up almost 10 to 30% of all common colds. They're called corona because when you look at them under electron microscopy, they look like a crown. So they're large envelope RNA viruses, which have their own virologic information. They're four genera, alpha, beta. These are the only ones that infect humans, but there's also delta and gamma. And maybe one day delta and gamma will infect humans. There's four endemic globally, right? I list them there, 229E, NL63, OV43, and HKU1. And they cause upper respiratory tract infections. And they are endemic, meaning they're always around. They're probably what's causing our flu-like upper respiratory tract infection up to one-third of the time. Their greatest variety is in bats because it appears that the bat is a major reservoir. I'm going to show you a picture of a person in a restaurant in Asia eating a bat. I can't imagine that. It must be a restaurant for the blind. Peridomestic mammals serve as intermediate hosts. I'm going to mention to you that that the camels got blamed for MERS. But most importantly is they have a surface spike S glycoprotein that's critical for binding to the host cell, meaning our epithelial cell. And that really is what represents the host determining factor. What will their glycoprotein bind to? If you don't have a key to get in the door, you don't get in the door. If you look at some of the HIV drugs that block the CD4 receptors, they work, but the virus can. There's a mutation that occurs can allow the virus to get into the back door, so to speak, a different T cell receptor. So the coronavirus outbreak has been a little attention given to mild phenotypes throughout the history of coronaviruses. But then 2002 showed up. And in 2002, all of a sudden, in the Guangdong province of China, there was an atypical pneumonia going on. That reminds me that when I was an intern at Penn in the early 80s, before HIV was really classified and defined as a retrovirus, that we would have a whole bunch of young, apparently previously healthy men come in with all sorts of odd things. I remember having a patient with disseminated MAC, CMV, pneumonia, and PCP. It was the PCP that got him in the door. And I remember saying to my intern, I don't know what's wrong with this guy, but something went wrong here. Something suddenly went wrong here. That was in 1982. How many times, if you remember back in the 80s, where we used to have what was called ARC, age-related complex, whatever that was, wasting syndrome. We did so many lymph node biopsies for non-specific lymphadenopathy and found nothing. So all of a sudden in 2002, we have a disease that's atypical, and we call it severe acute respiratory syndrome. That's not a name. That's describing a syndrome. That's like saying chronic fatigue syndrome. You tell your patient, I know what you have, chronic fatigue syndrome. They're so happy they have a name now, right? Fibromyalgia, achy fibers, okay? Now I know what's wrong with me. They hit the door, they turn around and say, isn't that what I told you that was wrong when I walked in, that I ached? And you told me that walking out, and everybody's happy. So all of a sudden there was a spread, right? With SARS, there was a spread international travel, but it wasn't quite as spread as this current coronavirus. And there were human-animal contact. That was what was discovered, that it appeared that the people who initially got infected had animal contact, and therefore it was a zoonotic infection. And bats were felt to be the natural host, okay? So Newsweek and Time magazine got right on it, and we had the SARS virus, and we had common symptoms of a cough and a dyspnea and a cold type thing and a fever, a little bit of watery diarrhea. About a third of them wound up on mechanical ventilation, and about 10% of them died. So keep that in mind, because this coronavirus is being heavily compared to SARS. In fact, it's called SARS coronavirus 2. And primarily, and I think this is interesting, is that the SARS glycoprotein receptor is the angiotensin converting enzyme 2. Now, I'm not promoting angiotensin receptor inhibitors, but I find that intriguing, and it will be very interesting as we move down the road. I'm not a virologist, to see if people who are on ARBs for their hypertension or whatever they're on it for get sick less or have less morbidity and less mortality. And then all of a sudden, the reason why the airborne and the reason why the N95 masks for a virus, when we don't put flu virus in airborne, we put them in droplet. One of the reasons is because when you go back and look at the community transmission that occurred in that hotel in Hong Kong where over 300 people became infected, they didn't have necessarily close contact with patient X. They may have been in the lobby, which would suggest airborne transmission. So when you see people wanting a surgical mask to walk down the street, when you walk down the street, it's not really droplet transmission unless you're walking with somebody who's coughing on you within 6 feet and there's continued contact. It's airborne transmission. So if you really wanted to walk around the street with a mask, it should be an N95 mask. Something under 5 microns that can travel in the air is trapped 95% of the time. That's basically what the number's standing for. So we knew that SARS had community transmission, and there was also other evidence of airborne transmission can occur. So there were public health measures taken. Public health measures we're going to talk about when we get to the end of this. And then all of a sudden, 10 years later, we have MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. Why is it called that? Because that's where it was first described in a Saudi man with another atypical pneumonia from another coronavirus that had changed. But this one was binding to a different receptor. This was glycoprotein S bound to what was called DPP4. And what's interesting about that receptor is that besides being found in the respiratory tract, it's also found in the gastrointestinal tract in the kidneys. So what was different about MERS than SARS was they also had gastrointestinal disease, a lot more diarrhea, and a lot more renal failure. Now, what's interesting about the SARS-1 and what we're calling SARS-2 now is that the majority of those receptors, those ACE2 receptors, are in the lower respiratory tract. Therefore, if more of it binds to the lower respiratory tract, you become more contagious because you produce more secretions and you become more ill because it's your lungs that are involved and not your upper respiratory tract. And that's why it's such a severe disease compared to other coronaviruses. So then MERS virus was blamed on bats possibly infecting camels and people being exposed to camels in the Middle Eastern part of the world. And it spread, and you can see that it was spread all over the world. It just wasn't quite the spread, and it was contained. It wasn't quite the spread as we're seeing with this virus. Now, I find this interesting. Just look at SARS and look at MERS, and this was a comparison back then. Look at the mortality rate, SARS versus MERS. Why was the MERS mortality so much greater, three times greater than SARS? And remember, these numbers are based on a denominator. You have to know the denominator. And you only know the denominator of people you diagnose. And you only diagnose sick people. So the numbers for me are a little bit hard. But the question is, why was that? Well, part of it is 58% of SARS, right, was nosocomial transmission. So you had a captured audience of who was getting sick. It was healthcare workers. 58% of transmission for SARS were healthcare workers. For MERS, right, it was even greater, and there was a greater mortality. I think the greater mortality from MERS came because of where it was binding to, and it was more virulent and affected more organ systems. Now, I don't know that. I'm not a virologist, but that's just my take on it. So then all of a sudden, the New England Journal comes out with the first report of novel coronavirus from patients with pneumonia in China, 2019. And now we have coronavirus COVID-19. And you're seeing all sorts of these pictures. I sort of like the one on the bottom. You know what? This isn't made up. Somebody actually did that, which is fascinating to me because I get asked that question all the time now. Can my pet get infected? Could they infect me? I don't know. You know, I don't have an answer for that. So on December 31st, the Chinese reported a cluster of pneumonia cases in Wuhan, China, and it was felt that the first people probably were in this fresh meat or fish market, and it's probably felt that these animals also got involved with bats, and we now have what's called COVID-19, and genetically it looked like SARS, so we're calling it SARS COVID virus 2, also binding to the same receptor. People blame China for being, you know, not communicating, for hiding it. Look, the first case was described in December 31. Now, I don't know if there were cases before that, but in 10 days later, the Shanghai Public Health Department released full information with the genomic sequence. That's pretty fast. I don't think blaming anybody for anything really is important. 15 healthcare workers all of a sudden got infected, meaning that there's nosocomial transmission, and now, as we know, there's sustained human-to-human community spread. And the first case that we know of was in this country coming up to 2 months ago, right? In about another 10 days, it will be 2 months. 2 months since the first case that we know of has been in this country, and we know how many cases have been documented, proven in this country. Just keep all that in mind when you think of how bad this is. Now, what I thought was interesting from this, and this was from the early New England Journal, right, is look at the exposure history and look at the contact with another person with respiratory symptoms, which is right down here. It's showing here, but also look at the wet market exposure. So when you look here, as time went on, very few people who got infected had anything to do with that market, which meant it was human-to-human spread. It was no longer just a zoonosis. So then countries with confirmed cases, well, they're all over the map. Yes, it's a pandemic. How many cases are in Russia? I have no clue. I look at that every day. The only country that I can sort of figure out that's never had a case yet is North Korea, right? That's like hospitals that used to have a so-called, you know, caudy rate or a central line infection disease bloodstream rate of so, and when it became zero and you didn't get reimbursed for keeping those people in the hospital, all of a sudden it was zero. It amazes me. I was out with a CEO who you may know for dinner the other night, who was the CEO of a large hospital here, and I said, I'm really interested, going back in time, that when core measures came out and expect zero and reimbursement for hospital-associated infections came about, your hospital went from X amount of bloodstream infections, central line, right, infections, to zero. And she said to me, it's pretty simple. You just stop counting them. I said, wow, okay. So how many countries really have exposure? I don't know, but it's all over the map. It's all over the map. If you're looking for a place to go that are none, I would suggest North Korea right now, right? So then the coronavirus, as far as we know, this is as of last evening at 4:30. They report Monday through Friday at 4 to 4:30. This is as of yesterday. The COVID-19 U.S. cases, 423 total cases. They said there were 19 deaths. 35 states reported it. The cases in the United States reported to the CDC. Well, you can see person-to-person spread, 29. Under investigation, 322. Total cases, 423. But then they put those little caveats at the bottom saying, we can't really tell you what the local and state departments are reporting because we don't have all the testing. If you look at which states in this country have reported, well, obviously, a lot of them. And it's going to be all of them. If you look hard enough, you'll find cases in your state. And then if you look at the case rate of when the illness onset came and et cetera, as time moved along, of course, as there's more cases, there's going to be more cases. And then you started getting visitor screening interim. In other words, people who come to the hospital, come to your office, what's the screening? Well, screen visitors and restrict entry for those who meet the following criteria, going to high-level transmission countries, China, Iran, South Korea, Italy, obviously. Yesterday, my son says, I'm going to visit some friends. I said, where are you gone? He doesn't listen to a thing he says. He lives in the northeast part of the country. I'm going to the Philippines. I said, great. I said, how are you getting there? Well, first, I'm going to a wedding in Los Angeles. I said, then where do you go? He said, South Korea. Meanwhile, every day he sends me an email wanting to know about the coronavirus. And I said, I don't think it's a good idea to go through South Korea. He said, what are you worried about? I said, nothing. It doesn't matter. He won't listen to me. Individuals who sign signs. So if you have anybody who's been in those countries and they have a fever, cough, or sore throat, in essence, basically what you should say is stay away from them. Don't come in the hospital. Stay home, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Public health laboratory testing is now available in every state in this country. And if you look at who should you test, this is the big issue. The big issue. Because just recently they opened up C. Before, it was a person who was symptomatic, cough, fever, shortness of breath, lower respiratory tract infection, who had either been in a zone where there's proven cases or been exposed to somebody who's proven to have the infection or been close to somebody who's proven to be under investigation. C opened up. C says, if you have a patient with a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, and you don't have an alternative diagnosis, then test them. Well, that's everybody. Because do we really have alternative diagnosis if it's flu negative? What's your alternative diagnosis? So yesterday, I had this havoc in this hospital that begins with a W. And I go in the ICU. I go in the ICU, and they tell me there's havoc here because they've ordered a COVID test, 19, on this patient in bed 18, this patient in bed 1, happened to be my patients. Because LabCorp opened up yesterday, right? And you can do a PCR from a nasal pharyngeal or a respiratory secretion swab and send it via that to LabCorp, and you'll get an answer in 3 to 4 days. Patient in bed 18. He's been there for 28 days. He got admitted with influenza A, and he has group B strep, secondary bacterial pneumonia, which is very necrotizing. He went into ARDS, a major gastrointestinal bleed, renal failure. He's on a ventilator, and he's getting dialyzed. And they want to test him for COVID-19. I said, maybe I don't know what's going on here, but tell me why. Because look how sick he is. I said, that would imply that he got it here. How about bed 1? He's been in the hospital 5 weeks. Said major pulmonary emboli, developed cavitary pneumonia. He probably came in with COPD and undiagnosed interstitial lung disease. The answer to me yesterday was, because the way his CAT scan looks like some of the pictures we're seeing. So, of course, I said, we're not going to test them. Because the place is going to become overwhelmed, and this is going to overwhelm everybody. But the problem is this. If somebody calls you up and says, I'm coughing, I have fever, and I have a productive sputum, right, you're not going to invite them to your office. Where are they going to get tested? I was on the phone with Alina Alonso Sunday before she went on and said there was a case in the convention center who went back up, you know, out of Florida. I was on the phone with her and saying, so what are you people doing for testing? We're telling them to go to their doctor. Well, here, how many are you inviting to your office? So you can see that's a major, major problem, see. You have to decide who you're really going to test. And you can see what happened when the testing became very available, locally and statewide. This was part of the issue that the CDC was concerned about. Who are you going to test? Well, it's easy to test everybody. And now that the government has forced all the payers to pay for the test, it's very easy to test everybody, right? And my wife, who's the director of my pathology and lab, said to me, this is going to be overwhelming because packaging the specimen and collecting it is overwhelming. It's going to overwhelm the lab because they're all being told to come to the ER. And it's very easy just to order the test. So then what's the interim guideline for collecting it? Well, it's lower respiratory tract and upper respiratory tract. It's a PCR test. You collect it with a nasopharyngeal swab, just like you would do a lot of viral cultures. They want a good specimen. We're not collecting blood. And if they're intubated, you would get a bronchial lavage. So what are the symptoms? Well, the symptoms are the obvious ones. Fever, cough, shortness of breath. Now, they say that 80% of people who are infected have a mild respiratory tract infection or no specific symptom. I want to know first, why'd you test them? Like, how do you know that number? 80% of people with Zika virus are not ill. Well, when they went back and looked at Ebola, and they said that Ebola is 100% fatal, and they did serologic testing in parts of Africa, 70% of the people they tested showed that they had previously been infected by serology and never had a symptom. So you really can't tell. You know, everybody says that rabies is 100% fatal. How would you know that? It's 100% fatal for the people who develop rabies encephalitis. How about the people who don't develop rabies encephalitis? So that 80% number makes me concerned. There's no specific lab finding, whether it's leukopenia, lymphocytosis, or whatever, thrombocytopenia, aminotransaminases going up. Secondary bacterial pneumonias, which is the leading cause of why people with influenza die, doesn't seem to be a big problem here. Having said that, if you did admit a patient with coronavirus and they had lower respiratory tract infection, I'd give them antibiotics. Because how are you really going to prove they don't have a secondary bacterial pneumonia, right? I would give them antibiotics and obviously try to diagnose a respiratory pathogen. Chest CAT scan seems to be a more specific finding than chest radiograph. The problem is we don't screen people with chest CAT scans when they're coughing or short of breath. This is a CAT scan, and you can see some early changes. You can see some changes here. There's nothing specific about this that says coronavirus. What it tells me is, yes, they have a lower respiratory tract disease. Usually my stethoscope and my history and physical tell me that also, right? A CAT scan showing a little bit more progression. I saw somebody on some show on TV touting that this should be the diagnostic method and we should skip all this PCR stuff. I wanted to call him up and say, so where's your CAT scan center, right? Which is the one you own? So here's some more changes. You can see it becoming a little bit more ground glass, and you can see that this chest x-ray is evolving a little bit more like a lower respiratory tract infection. Obviously, the CT scan is evolving also, which brings us to what do you do with people for prevention? Well, it's obvious. You're going to put them in respiratory isolation. The question is what kind? Well, it's recommended airborne. Airborne requires an N95 mask. I don't know how many airborne rooms you have here. I could tell you at the average-sized hospital, they probably don't have more than 12 that are usable. Some are in ORs that are usable. What are you going to do if you admit 20 people? You don't have airborne rooms. Yes, you can use N95 masks if you can find one, but they're going to be basically in rooms with the door closed. An airborne room means the air is exchanged 6 to 12 times an hour, and it's dumped somewhere. You ever wonder where that air is going? Do you ever wonder where that air is going? Think about that. It's going outside. Through a HEPA filter, right? That's where do you think it's going? Okay. So airborne isolation, personal protection equipment, and environmental infection control, right? So normally we would only put things in airborne isolation like TB, varicella, measles, but now we're putting coronavirus in airborne isolation. But if you tell them to go home, they're not in airborne isolation. And for us, it's personal protection equipment, which includes goggles, because obviously you can touch your eyes with secretions, the N95 mask, gloves, because of contact. It's fomite-driven also. It lives on fomites. I hear estimates, well, it lives on the surface at 72 degrees Fahrenheit for 18 hours. How the heck would you know that? I mean, why even say that? All I would say is disinfect the surface. I don't know how long it's living there. I can't put a stopwatch on it. No shoes and shoes or boot covers. It's really high-level personal protective equipment. Do you ever wonder what's the difference between a disinfectant and an antiseptic? Well, an antiseptic and a disinfectant both are antimicrobial, but they don't necessarily kill every pathogen, and they're not necessarily sporicidal, where sterilization kills everything. If you want to sterilize a patient, autoclave them. Or gas them, right? If you want to disinfect something, a surface, you can use a lot harsher materials than you can with antiseptics, because antiseptics are used on tissues. But the goal is that they kill or inhibit so-called germicidal. Don't get confused with the word cidal versus static when it comes to antibiotics. There are a lot of static drugs that if you give enough of it will be cidal, because the definition of cidal is that the MBC, the how quick you kill them, is no greater than 8 times the MIC. Well, you can reach that by giving more drug. Clindamycin is cidal for Staph aureus if you give enough of it. So don't get too confused. So when we talk about germicidal, that implies it's killing it if you have enough of it there. So how much enough antiseptic do you need? Do you ever look at the back of those Purells or whatever it is that people buy with alcohol wipes? Anybody know how much number of ethyl alcohol you need for it to really be virucidal or bactericidal? The FDA, most times, right, doesn't tell you if a product is that, just like the FDA doesn't regulate supplements or probiotics. That's not their job. Their job is to protect you, not to tell you if it will help you. They just want to know it won't hurt you. Okay, so 60% or more of ethyl alcohol is felt to be cidal. So look at the product you buy. A lot of them aren't, which is very interesting. So then what's the treatment? Well, I always love supportive. I don't know how to actually order supportive on CPOE, right? But if you look at what works, well, chloroquine, right, the old malaria standby, that's been suggested that it may have benefit. No confirmed data. How about lopinavir, ritonavir, which is Caltrate, one of the early protease inhibitor HIV drugs? The problem with that is that the inhibitory or cidal concentration of Caltrate for HIV viruses to become less active is terrible. It's no better, really, for COVID-19, although some people are thinking about that. I'm a little bit interested in the bottom drug there, remdesivir, which is a broad-spectrum antiviral drug, a polymerase inhibitor, right? It's a broad-spectrum RNA polymerase inhibitor, and there's lots of trials going on. Gilead owns that drug, and that's in active trials right now in a lot of places. And I have a lot of hope for that drug. And then, of course, you could always go to the old standby, right? Breaking news, right? Perhaps that will work. That's what's going to have to happen. Vaccine. Vaccines is what changed the world. What changed the world? Not antibiotics, not ICUs, not advanced heart surgery. It's clean water and vaccination is what changed the world and why we have 8 billion people right now. Vaccines and clean water. So then, information for travelers. If you're going to a zone that's called Travel Zone 3, China, Iran, I wouldn't go. Italy's on that list now. South Korea's getting on that list. The United States has no restrictions. Most of Europe has no restrictions. I tell them, as far as, are you worried about spreading something or somebody spreading it to you? It's what your mom and dad taught you. It's like sort of common sense measures, right? Hand cleaning and respiratory control. Travelers from countries with widespread things, you warn them of the symptoms. I get these calls every day. I have this trip planned to France next month. Should I go? I said, I'd go. I without getting into the details, I would go. Otherwise, you're going to be sitting home for a long time. Other things that the CDC is putting out for health alerts, mostly aimed at patients, right? If you feel sick and have these symptoms, call your doctor. Now it's in our hands. And then, of course, what will happen and how will this end? Well, like all previous pandemics have ended, the human experiment will adapt. It's called natural survival, survival of the fittest. It's called herd immunity. Why did we have a measles outbreak? Because the herd immunity dropped. That was our creation. The anti-vaccine people created the measles outbreak and the global travel. Organized assessment and selective quarantine. If somebody calls you up and says, I think I could be ill, what do you tell them? Stay home. Stay away from people. Right? And perhaps we don't want to get to the bottom. We don't want to be looking for intelligence all over the world when we have to look within our world that we live in, hopefully that there is intelligence here and some common sense. So having said that, thank you for coming, and I hope that wasn't too much too fast. Yes. Yes.
Why is the experience in Italy so exceptional?
I think the experience in Italy is so exceptional because there was a large part of travel there from people who were infected early on, and they spread it amongst them. And I don't think they got on top of the quarantining as fast as some other places like this country has done. And when you really think about it, the first case that we know of has been here almost 2 months. And when you think about how many cases have been diagnosed, how many people are really sick, it's really a small number. Are we going to see cases? No, as of yesterday, Alina Alonso said there are no documented cases in Palm Beach County. The problem is now that it's opened up to commercial lab testing, of course we're going to see cases. She's gone by what was done at the CDC because the state and local lab didn't have the testing until about a week ago. So are there cases in Palm Beach County? Oh, yeah. I had a doctor from Boca call me the other day that he had a patient who came back from that part of Italy who was there for 3 weeks and now is home with a fever and short of breath and coughing. Yeah, I think she'll be a case. She's getting tested today. I think she'll be a case. I mean, sounds like she should be a case. Yes. Quest will treat it like they treat, and LabCorp will treat it like they treat HIV and hepatitis C, et cetera. Any reportable disease, whether you report it or gonorrhea or syphilis or I report it, they will report it to the local health department. That will go on to the state, which will go on to the CDC. So we'll have the diseases from those tested. You won't know the denominator. You won't know how many were tested, how many were positive. You'll only know how many were positive because they don't report the negatives. Yes.
When you get that phone call, you know, shortness of breath, fever, and high suspicion, how do you want us to handle that?
So what I do with those phone calls is I treat them like any other patient who would call me who may have the flu. If they're not that ill, right, I tell them to stay home and do the usual measures, et cetera, et cetera. If they're ill, then they have to be assessed. And unfortunately, it's going to have to be somewhere where you can assess them rapidly, which will mean imaging. You know, do they have a secondary, do they have a bacterial process, et cetera? And they're going to have to come to hospitals.
Quest is going to have those, like LabCorp, Quest will be available next week, according to the rep. But yesterday I had a suspicious one, and we actually made a car call. I had her in the parking lot, and we just did the swabs, and treated her supportive.
But when you did the swabs, theoretically, you're supposed to have all that personal protective equipment on. You'd have to send them to a center who, you know, I won't be shocked if a place like MD Now starts to advertise that they can handle this, right? It's obviously business. Yeah. But I don't know if they can handle the PPE yet because that's also, you know, a guideline for OSHA that you have to follow those PPEs. Yes. I wouldn't hold their injections because I don't think your immune system recovers that quickly. No, I would continue it. I would just have them not travel and have social distancing. I think as the weather warms, like all flu viruses, respiratory viruses, because they don't adapt as well when there's more humidity. I think it will decline when there's more humidity in the respiratory tract. Yes. I think right now, unless you can really show huge numbers of human-to-human spread in our county or our state or our country, I would continue it. If you were ill, obviously, I wouldn't go. But I wouldn't shut things down. I mean, that's what's killing the economy, right? It's that. I wouldn't shut things down because when would you open it? What would be the number that says it's safe? There's continually going to be spread. Yes. Hi.
I think the very important thing is what you just said a second ago, is that you have to urge patients to be nice to other people. If they have any minor respiratory symptoms, don't show up at any gate. Don't go to a meeting. Don't go to a convention. Don't go to church, you know, they have to be sympathetic to the rest. You know, that's the most important lesson you can give to your patient. You know, the patient has what is going to turn out to be most likely a URI. Just don't show up and infect everybody. Yeah, regardless of COVID-19, it could be just simple influenza or anything else. Just stay home.
Exactly right. Yeah, I agree. Yes. So from the early information coming out, at least from China, the RNA, that you can detect the virus in the respiratory secretions for quite some time. The question is, are they as contagious at that point? And just like it happened with Zika, we was able to find Zika virus in men's semen for weeks and months on end, and the recommendation was, if you're thinking of becoming pregnant, you know, to avoid that for X amount of months. You know, you're looking at outliers, and it's very hard to, in population medicine, to make that recommendation. It's like, I don't know exactly when you're no longer shedding flu. Our recommendation, if you just look at TB, is after you're on treatment and you have negative AFB smears, you probably are still shedding some degree of mycobacterium, but you seem to be not a concern contagious-wise. One more question. Yes. Yeah, I think droplet is perfectly fine because the most of the spread is going to be what's defined as close contact, which is prolonged face-to-face time within 6 feet. I mean, for me, airborne is totally non-measurable, and I would go with droplet. And I think hospitals are going to have to go with droplet like they do with influenza. Yes, go ahead, Len. To my understanding, none have been reported. That doesn't mean there hasn't been any. So from the reporting of, let's say, at this point, around 115,000 cases. Remember, those are only the people who were tested.
No, I'm just talking about the deaths.
Out of that, there's been a little bit under, somewhere in the 3% mortality rate. Yeah, I don't think there's been early on a lot of cases in healthcare workers originally in China, but I don't know of anybody of those who've died that I know have reported other than apparently their original physician. All right, well, thank you.